You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 25th of March 2022 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist with Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, for the first time in three decades, an American president comes to Europe rattled by Russia. We'll examine Joe Biden's visit. Also ahead, we have an update on Malta's parliamentary elections, and we find out how India and China are hoping to mend their often tense relationship. And then the top stories from the world of fashion and Andrew Muller's unique assessment of what we've learned in the last 7 days.
UEFA had received a bid to host the 2028 European Football Championships from Russia. So we learned that we may have to rethink the popular stereotype of Russians as pessimists.
That's all coming up on The Globalist, live from London. First, a quick look at what else is happening in today's news. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has said Europe was a little too late in stopping Russia's invasion and should have done more to sanction Moscow. North Korea has confirmed it has successfully launched its largest intercontinental ballistic missile. Australia says it's monitoring reports that China may establish a military presence in the Solomon Islands. And Art Basel has announced details for its newest edition in Paris. You can find out more at monocle.com/minute. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, there is a hot war in Ukraine and for the first time in three decades, a cold war with Russia in the rest of Europe. It is in these circumstances that the US President Joe Biden is in Poland today, following his address to NATO and to European Union leaders in Brussels. NATO, meanwhile, is to deploy four new battle groups to its eastern allies to bolster their deterrence against Russia. Well, for more on this, I'm joined by Joanna Pluchinska, who's a political journalist for Reuters based in Warsaw. Good morning, Joanna.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. So just explain to us what Joe Biden is intending to do in Poland today.
So today he's arriving in the afternoon, and the main event of the day is meeting with U.S. soldiers and also meeting with humanitarian experts on the ground to understand the situation at the border with the refugee crisis. And that's going to be the primary focus of today. Tomorrow he's meeting with Poland's President Andrzej Duda, and he's going to give a speech to express solidarity with Poland.
It's a very huge symbol, isn't it, to have the US president meeting both soldiers and refugees in a country such as Poland. I mean, how significant does this feel for Poland itself?
I think it's important for Poland, especially that this is, you know, in the lead up to previous visits by senior officials from the U.S., especially given the fact that before this war started, Poland's relationship with the Biden administration was not that strong, especially if you compare it to Poland's relationship with the Trump administration. So I think this is kind of putting Poland in a new light, especially amidst the refugee crisis. There's a lot of support towards Poland internationally. There's a sense that Poland has really accepted in millions of people that it's taking the brunt of this crisis. So it's really reset Poland's international reputation.
And that can do nothing but good for Poland in its international stage, but it has accepted a tremendous burden with this, hasn't it?
Yes. I mean, millions of refugees are coming through. If you look at, especially in the big cities in Poland, in Warsaw, for example, there are not enough apartments and homes to host the refugees that are coming in. A lot of Poles have taken refugees into their own homes in an effort to kind of contain the crisis. And a lot of this is being done on a grassroots level. It's people who are working, you know, locally, building local networks through their communities, and just reacting to people coming in as they come in. But I remember even after the first week of the crisis, there was already a lack of apartments in Warsaw.
Where does this leave Poland politically? Because for years and years, obviously, Poland has lived under communist rule. But in the last few years, it has pushed back against the European Union and has found itself quite isolated. What does the Ukrainian conflict mean for Poland now?
I think in some ways, it I don't want to say that it redeems the Polish government's narrative, especially its incredibly Russo-skeptic narrative. But I think there's a sense, Poland has a sense that we were warning you for so long, we were telling you this would happen, and now it's happening, and we were right. I think we also saw when there was the protests in Belarus in 2020, a similar reaction that Poland was saying, you know, this is something that we have expected for a long time and we're on the front line of this. So I think Poland is really showing to the European Union that it is protecting and standing on Europe's border and taking in these people and taking really the brunt of this for the European Union.
And if something militarily were to happen, were the conflict to spill over past Ukraine, the likelihood is that it would spill over into Poland.
There is a lot of speculation right now that would be the case. I think the Baltic countries are also concerned about that. But Poland is certainly the biggest NATO ally on the eastern flank. When you look at that, it's the biggest country. It's where most of the refugees are going. And Russia has even recently put out statements criticizing Poland. So I think there is an increasing concern that Poland could be the next to be hit.
And as a result, it is a very reassuring thing to have an American president on their territory, given the fact that Poland has such a strong tie with the United States. I think just looking back to the Cold War, Ronald Reagan was absolutely revered in Poland at the time, wasn't he?
He was, absolutely. He continues to be. I think Poland has always looked to the United States as a role model, even if you look culturally. A lot of Polish people idolize American culture. In America, there's a huge Polish diaspora in the U.S. I think that, like I said, there were previous doubts about the Polish relationship with the Biden administration, especially this current administration, which has been accused of being nationalist, incredibly conservative, anti-LGBT. And now there's a sense that, okay, there's wartime, we're going to forget about some of those issues and just stand in solidarity together.
And what leverage does that give to Poland when it comes to negotiating and getting help?
I think it's unclear, but I exactly what sort of leverage it receives. But I do think that perhaps there's a sense that Poland hopes that its voice might be louder on international forums. There was a proposal for Poland to join the G20 to replace Russia that was put forward by the Polish president. I think there are hopes that Poland's international position and international voice will simply be more credible, given that it is taking such a huge amount of refugees in and providing so much support.
Moving more broadly on to the presence of President Biden and the way that Europe is moving together against Russia, I mean, how impressed is the EU with Joe Biden at the moment?
I think that's difficult to tell, but clearly there's a reliance on Joe Biden's voice. There's a sense that he is very clear in calling for stronger sanctions. I think Ukraine might not be as impressed with its Western allies. There's still no full boycott on Russian energy, and there's no no-fly zone that wasn't agreed yesterday in Brussels. So there are still a lot of potential sanctions and things to do moving forward that are under discussion and will probably continue to be in the coming weeks.
There is that feeling, though, isn't there? I mean, as you mentioned there, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky came out in the last few hours in saying that the European Union, actually the rest of the world, didn't act strongly enough before the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Is there a sense, therefore, that the US-EU alliance needs to galvanise more under the umbrella of NATO?
Certainly, I think a lot of critics say that, you know, Russian President Vladimir Putin was planning this for a very, very long time. There were many warning signs. Recently, there was even a letter in the Financial Times from a UK diplomat who was saying, you know, he was stationed in Moscow in 2015, I think, and that even then they knew that this was coming. So I think there's an overall sense that the West fell asleep at the wheel And now they're catching up. And of course, the U.S. has pledged billions of dollars in military support for Ukraine and continues to do so. But at the same time, you know, we see, again, going back to Poland, Poland is now calling for a humanitarian force to be sent into Ukraine. We're not sure what's going to happen with that, how that's going to move forward. But in general, I think Ukraine is, you know, stuck feeling that they were left behind on this.
How much in the long term, then, are we looking at the relationship between the US, the EU, and the fact that we have a hot war in Ukraine, but we certainly have what looks very much like a cold war springing up in Europe now on Poland's borders? In the long term issues associated with that and how the West sort of reassesses its situation is a huge one, isn't it?
It is. I think one of the biggest questions is Europe's reliance on Russian energy. I think that's something, again, that was not foreseen or not seen with urgency, and now is going to be a huge issue for Europe's economies. Moving away from Russian gas supplies, when I think it makes up over 40% of the reliance, it's something that would, in normal times, take years to implement. And now that schedule has just shrunk dramatically. So I think that's going to really hit the wallets of Europeans. It's going to be something that everyone feels. Already everyone is feeling the economic repercussions of this war. And as a lot of leaders have warned, things are likely to get worse before they get better.
And in the long term for Poland, I mean, existentially, to know that you're back in something which many people hoped we were done with 30 years ago.
Yes, but I do think that a lot of Poles feel that that they saw this coming. From a defense perspective, certainly there is a sense that, you know, Poland is saying this is why they've been asking for U.S. troops for such a long time. Poland also has been investing significantly into its military, above the 2% NATO spending recommendation. So I think that a lot of Poles aren't surprised. Certainly when you speak with people in the generation who lived through World War II and communism, and those people are still alive, many of them, they're very sad to see what's happening, but it's something that they've lived through, and they just see that this is part of Poland's history. It's in the middle of two powers, of Europe and Russia, and that this is going to continue in the course of its history.
Joanna Pluczynska on the line from Warsaw there. Thank you so much for joining us. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24.
It's Monocle's 15th anniversary. So come and celebrate with us in St. Moritz, high up in the Swiss Alps. Join Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck, our editors, and me, Georgina Godwin, from the 1st to the 3rd of April for a special weekend of talks, walks, drinks and dancing. You'll also meet celebrated Dutch writer Ilja Leonard Pfeiffer, author of the bestseller Grand Hotel Europa. We'll debate the future of the continent with the author and discuss the state of the media with our editors at St. Moritz's own Grand Hotel, Civretta House. We'll dance until late at the Dracula Club, sample the best of Engadine hospitality, and host a live edition of Monocle on Sunday. And there'll be skiing on offer too, as well as a special spring preview of our latest collaborations from our pop-up shop at Super Mountain Market. We'd love you to come to our high-altitude spring weekender, though places are strictly limited, so sign up soon through the events section of our website. See you in St. Moritz at the Monocle Weekender.
It's 15:14 in Beijing, 7:14 here in London. You're back with The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. Now to another long-running geopolitical crisis, that of the strained relationship between India and China and efforts to mend it. China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi is in Delhi on the first India visit by a senior leader from Beijing since the two nations' armies fought each other on the border last May. Well, I'm joined now by Dr. Sajan Gohel, who's a visiting teacher at the London School of Economics and International Security Director at the Asia Pacific Foundation. Good morning, Sajan.
Good morning.
Let's place this in a bit of context, shall we, this visit? Relations are at an all-time low between the two nations.
The relationship between China and India is unfortunately problematic right now. That is going back to what you mentioned, which is the skirmish that took place back on May 2020, in which both sides actually fought against each other in the Galwan Valley, which is in the Himalayas. There is a territorial dispute that goes back decades. And the belief was that China had effectively broken the arrangement that had existed previously and moved further into territory that is disputed. That standoff still remains to this day, although it's not as precarious as it was before. But unfortunately, those tensions remain, and they have not been resolved as yet.
We saw some, the reports are that at least 20 Indian soldiers died last year, and at least 4 Chinese troops were killed as well, although those numbers were never absolutely verified. So it's in these circumstances that the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi has arrived in what the media is saying is unannounced.
Well, in fact, the numbers, it's believed that China probably lost over 30, which now some reports are suggesting that it could have even been higher than that. So because China doesn't actually reveal its fatalities, unlike India. And this trip, it's an interesting one because Wang Yi has just come via Afghanistan when he had meetings with the Taliban. And then prior to that, he was in Pakistan as well, and then he's going to Nepal after the India trip. So this seems to be a regional coordinated effort by the Chinese Foreign Ministry. Whether it's going to actually achieve anything remains to be seen, but perhaps the expectation is that by having dialogue face to face in this post-pandemic era may help to ease tensions, but it's very unlikely that this is going to result in anything significant. It's perhaps just the starting point of a very long journey to try and see if relations can improve. And then we have to put emphasis on the word can.
Indeed. So what do people hope can be done?
Well, I think the Indians want there to be a de-escalation in the number of troops on the border. They want China to pull back because Chinese troops are very close to where the dispute is taking place. And the other concern is that they are building infrastructure there, which means that it could be permanent. It means that China may want to extend further. And that's also what created the tensions back in May 2020. So India wants China to take steps to de-escalate this troop movement that is there on the border. And keep in mind, China and India share a very long border in 3 different parts of their respective countries. It's in the Himalayas. It's also where you've got place Sikkim and Nepal area. And then you've also got the other part, which is in the northeast of India and in the southern part of Tibet. So these 3 areas have often resulted in tensions in the past. And it's not just one area that the 2 countries are going to have to resolve. It's 3 areas.
One thing that also complicates issues enormously is Ukraine, because India and China, as we have been talking about, have had huge standoffs on the border. India, many have suggested, have said it needs to court Russia in order to feel as if they are supported and they are bolstered. But both sides, both India and China at the moment, find themselves being one of the few large nations in the world to not openly support Russia, but not condemning the war.
Well, in China's case, there is a strategic relationship with Russia. They do support each other significantly. It's worth keeping in mind that President Xi Jinping of China has met Vladimir Putin of Russia 38 times in the last 10 years, which is a significant number. And think about the fact that 2 of those years have gone in the pandemic itself. For India, there is this relationship that goes back from the period of the Cold War during the Soviet era, where India ended up becoming dependent on Russian military hardware. And as we've been talking about this tension between India and China, and also the fact that India has difficult relationships with Pakistan as well, and then you have the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan, India's big concern is that if there is another war, if there is another crisis, they need to have enough military supplies to protect themselves. So that remains the concern that India has, is that they have to tread very carefully in this relationship with Russia. And it's also worth mentioning that India does have good relations with Ukraine at a bilateral level. The thing that the U.S. wants from India is to diversify its military hardware equipment, but that's going to take years. The process has begun, but it's not something that can get fixed very quickly.
And returning to China's visit to India at the moment, you mentioned just there the issue of Pakistan, and you also mentioned the issue of Afghanistan. The Chinese foreign minister's visit to India comes on the back of a trip or a meeting with the Pakistanis, in which he said that he supported he was more in favour of the Pakistanis' take on the Kashmir issue. But also, he's just visited the Taliban in Kabul.
It's very surreal because you have the Chinese foreign minister Wang Yi as the guest of honour at a meeting that the Pakistanis held for the Organization of Islamic Countries, in which one of the main issues of concern was Islamophobia, and yet the dynamic of Xinjiang and the Uyghurs was not mentioned whatsoever. And then, as you said, Wang Yi also made a surprise visit to Afghanistan to meet the Taliban, which is, again, a very bizarre dynamic, because the Taliban are a radical Islamist group, and you have the Chinese who are the PRC, which is effectively a communist state, and the two should not actually be working together. It should make zero sense on paper, and yet there is this odd collaboration that's beginning, which is based on strategic and economic priorities. The Chinese want to enhance their investments in Afghanistan, but they also want the Taliban to crack down on Uyghur dissidents that operate there. And in turn, the Taliban want recognition from China. How this relationship is going to develop remains to be seen, because it just it defies all logic. But then this is geopolitics.
Sajan Gohil, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. Still to come on today's Globalist, the day's papers, a fashion update with Dana Thomas, and then Andrew Muller runs us through his take on the week's events.
We learned this week that a divided nation narrowly voting to leave an economic and customs union because an amount of its citizens don't like foreigners very much, and a nation unifying to mount a heroic armed resistance in an existential struggle against a predatory invader are literally exactly the same thing.
Stay tuned on The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
/8:22 in Rome, /7:22 here in London. Now for the EU's smallest member state, Malta has some big issues. It is on the grey list of the international watchdog on money laundering. 5 years ago, the journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia was brutally murdered as well, with her death later found to have involved government officials. She was investigating reports of links between the Maltese government and wealthy Russian oligarchs. Well, it is in this context that voters in Malta go to the polls this weekend to take part in parliamentary elections. And joining me now from Bukhara in Malta is Matthew Schwereb, who's assistant editor at the Times of Malta. Good morning, Matthew.
Good morning. Good morning, Emma, and good morning to all your listeners.
It is great to have you. It is an astonishing catalogue of problems that Malta faces at the moment, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But ironically, it's none of these things that you mentioned will have any bearing on the election that is happening tomorrow. The polls show, the surveys show that the Labour Party will win with another landslide majority, because it seems that the people of Malta are more interested in what's going into their pockets rather than what's happening to the country as a whole.
So tell us how we have got to this situation then.
It all started in 2013. Just for your listeners to understand, Malta is a very polarized country. We have two main political parties, the Labour Party and the Nationalist Party, known as the Reds and the Blues. We have the Green Party and a lot of small parties, but they get very little votes in the elections. It all started in 2013 after 25 years of a nationalist government. Joseph Muscat promised to change things in Malta for the better. A lot of things were changed. But unfortunately, 2013, we started with the scandals. There has been a count of about 150 scandals since Labour returned to government in 2013. I mean, the first one, just a few days after being elected to power, we had the chief of staff of the prime minister and one of the main ministers opening a secret bank account in Panama, where they were expected to receive payments of some sort. That is when it started, and then it culminated with the assassination of Daphne Caruana Galizia in 2017 during this legislature.
Bringing us up to date now, Matthew, we have the situation with the current Prime Minister lending his villa to wealthy Russian individuals, and this idea of people being able to, well, in particular, wealthy Russians being able to use Malta as a way of sidestepping possible EU sanctions, because it is comparatively easy, dare I say it, to get Maltese citizenship if you are very wealthy.
Yes, that was one of the only economic sectors that the Labour government created in these past 9 years. We started our golden passport scheme, where wealthy people, not only Russians but Chinese primarily as well, would use Malta to get one foot into the EU. They would buy the Maltese passports, and with this supposed link to Malta, they should be here for an amount of time. But we all know, and everyone knows, including the government, that none of them come to Malta. But they just use their money to make the investments that they have to make the charitable donations that they have to make, and that is it. And obviously Malta was criticized by other EU countries and even the European Commission about it. Even the European Parliament called earlier this month, they called for it to stop, and it's been paused. So at the moment, applications from Russians aren't being processed, finally, because it took the government weeks to decide on this.
What does this mean, therefore, for Malta's relationship within the European Union? You have just given us a list of the criticism coming from the EU, but the way it is being seen globally, the fact that it has issues with money laundering, with gambling, with goodness knows what, as well as this problem with the Russians, could make this very small place a very big problem for the rest of the world.
Yes, that is how it's being seen. In fact, Malta has a case that it's fighting in the European Court of Justice about this passport scheme, where it's defending it. To be fair with the government, they changed it. They changed some of the rules around it, but it's still seen in across the EU. It's still seen as the back door for these wealthy people to get into the EU. And from Malta, it's seen as easy money, because the money is being invested in social projects, in roads infrastructure, and several other projects that are being used, even charitable projects, so helping NGOs and whatnot. So people are looking at it as easy money, as money that's coming falling out of the sky, literally. But it does give us problems on an EU level. Yeah.
Finally, Matthew, as assistant editor at the Times of Malta, what is it like trying to cover your patch at the moment, given the fact that you have stories that would dominate the headlines in much bigger countries?
Yes, it's not easy. It's not easy. But the impression we've been getting is that none of these stories damage the government in any way. The surveys, consistent surveys, show that the majority is increasing, is on the increase, and Labour is set to win with another landslide majority as it did in 2017 and in 2013, with a majority of around 39,000 votes, which for Malta it's historic. It's quite a lot. Yes.
Well, I wish you the best for everybody on your editorial floor. Matthew Schwerab, assistant editor at the Times of Malta. Thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist. A quick look at the headlines now. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has said Europe was a little too late to stop Russia's invasion and should have done more to sanction Moscow. Mr. Zelensky's comments follow an emergency summit of NATO members in Brussels. North Korea has confirmed that it has successfully launched its largest intercontinental ballistic missile. Yesterday's test marked the first time the country tested an ICBM since 2017. The UN has banned North Korea from testing such weapons. Australia says it's monitoring reports that China may establish a military presence in the Solomon Islands. Leaked documents show plans for a security deal between China and the Pacific nation, which lies about 2,000 kilometres from Australia. And Art Basel has announced details for its newest edition in Paris. The fair, which opens in October, will be directed by Clément Delépine and named Paris Plus by Art Basel. You can find out much more by signing up to our online digest at monocle.com/minute. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Now, in the days after Russia's invasion of Ukraine began, Monocle's Alexei Korolev visited Romania as it and other nations along the country's western frontier braced for Europe's largest refugee crisis since the Second World War. Well, in the cities and villages of northern Romania, the Russian invasion is all people are thinking and talking about. But it's not just talk. There's been a fantastic response from local organisations and NGOs as they seek to provide shelter and transportation to new arrivals. But Romania is one of the poorest countries in the European Union, so how will the influx of Ukrainian refugees change the country's cities? Here's Alexei with more.
Florin Morishan never imagined he'd be starting his new job during wartime. He became spokesman for the prefecture of Satu Mare just a few days before the Russian invasion.
It's hard to imagine that 80 years after the Second World War, it's happening all over again. I remember the stories my grandparents told me. I've seen the documentaries.
On the day I visit, the weather is bright and dry, and dozens of people are soaking up the sun in Satu Mare's central square. It is a picture of peace and tranquility. But Florin Murishan is afraid it won't last. The Ukrainian border is just 40 kilometers away.
Parcă lumea a uitat și de COVID și de criza prețurilor și toate ședințele.
Everything has changed. It's as though everybody forgot about the pandemic and the economic problems. The only thing we're talking about is Ukraine and how we can help.
S-a schimbat practic.
My first desire was to go there just to save my family, etc. But at the same time, I was thinking to myself.
The region's other major city, Baia Mare, is home to thousands of ethnic Ukrainians. Yaroslava Burlachenko is one of them.
I don't know how to describe this feeling. I just felt that, oh my God, what can I do that I'm here, they are there, what can I do for them? I was feeling lost. What can I do?
Yaroslava is a professional handballer, and she plays on the Ukrainian national team. But right now, handball is the last thing on her mind.
Immediately after I finish my training, I take the phone and I am non-stop on my phone. I don't know, I am going to sleep maybe at 5 in the morning, and at 9 in the morning I wake up and I go to training. And immediately I finish the training, I go into my phone and I start to coordinate to help the people to find a safe place.
Both Satu Mare and Baia Mare are large cities, capable of handling a sudden influx of people. But Romania's frontier towns further north are getting overwhelmed. Sighetu Marmației is one of the gateways for Ukrainian refugees, and it is full. But here too, the spirit is one of welcome and hospitality.
My name is Toby Fricker, and I'm a UNICEF Emergency Communications Specialist. I think the response from local organisations has been fantastic. I mean, we see here at the Sighetu border crossing, we see a number of local organisations, families, people who've come together to support people leaving Ukraine. And I think, the response has been fantastic. The authorities have been very open. The border crossing points are open. And everyone is coming together, essentially, to help because they see women and children primarily fleeing Ukraine. Yeah. And everyone wants to do their part.
Almost 600,000 Ukrainians have crossed into Romania since the start of the war. It's unclear what will happen to them, where they will go, what they will do. But one thing is certain. Romania and Romanian cities will never be the same again. For Monocle, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Thank you, Alexei. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. The time here in London is 7:36. Let's have a look at the newspapers now. Joining me on the line is the writer, journalist and broadcaster Caroline Frost. Good morning, Caroline. Just take us through the papers, would you mean? What's the first thing that you've spotted today? It's the New York Times, isn't it? And Russian journalists. And a story about Russian journalists.
Yeah, so obviously it's a very troubling time for particularly state television employees, which formed a huge majority of Russian journalists. The New York Times is reporting them to be completely fed up with the propaganda that they are charged with espousing, and increasing numbers of them are trying to find ways of quitting. We've seen a couple go out in high fashion. I mean, we saw the journalist last week very bravely making sure that all her viewers knew it was a stunt that she was involved in, and she has been fined 30,000 rubles. However, lots of others are trying to just slip off slightly more quietly, less controversially, but clearly the stakes are high. And as we know, President Putin exerts an iron grip over his state propaganda machine, the media in Russia. And so all these things are being very carefully monitored. So it's not an easy time, but it's heartwarming to know that some people aren't just listening and believing everything they even say, let alone hear.
The New York Times highlights a really interesting dilemma that workers, the broadcasters in Russia have, insofar as steady work and the creative challenge, what the New York talks about, that the enjoyment, the pleasure of actually making news is something which is compelling for someone if you want to do that as a job. Nonetheless, you have to strike a bargain with the fact that the Kremlin is using you as propaganda. So clearly the line has been crossed now.
Yes, it does. I mean, all of us, I think, in journalist world relate to sometimes we don't necessarily believe every single thing our publishers and our paymasters tell us to print. We know that certain ideologies are beyond the pale. However, I think that we must feel relatively well off when we read stories like this, when, as you say, the stakes are so high. This has been, I mean, for years, this has been bubbling for lots of journalists, and they do satisfy themselves that they are doing a good job and being professional and doing it well. But I think this invasion of Ukraine does represent the line in the sand that has been crossed for many of them, and so they're just trying to find a way out while, as you say, keeping a roof over their heads.
And it's interesting to note that all of Russia's national television networks are controlled by the Kremlin, but the amount of reliance that people have on state broadcasting has dropped since 2014, and people are looking more at social media, which obviously gives a much bigger problem for the likes of Meta, Facebook, running whatever it is, who are deciding not to take part in Russia at the moment, where actually they could be doing an enormously important job.
Yes, we saw that, didn't we, with the uprisings a decade ago, that many communications were being enjoyed on social media, particularly by youthful audiences who are curious and hungry for knowledge that is not the same just state machine being pumped out that their ancestors have seen for decades. But yes, with this clampdown, the challenge is how to get that information to them. So it'd be very interesting to see what goes on, because this curiosity is not going to go away. So it will just be a case of, I guess, policemen and rabbit, really. Sort of, they will seek freedom and new channels and invent new channels, and the state will try and run after them to clamp them down as quickly as they arrive. But it's just a case of, I suppose, in terms of this particular struggle, of which will triumph ultimately.
Let's move on to a story in the Times. It's a story that's been dominating the headlines in the United Kingdom, at least, which is the sacking of hundreds of staff who work on the P&O ferry company. It was done in a 3-minute online call last week. And everybody at the time was absolutely astonished by just how brutal the removal of P&O staff was from their ferries. They sent security guards in with no notice. And suddenly the boss has had to admit at a parliamentary committee that they did the wrong thing.
Yes, yeah, so this might sound a little bit small town on the face of it, because this is ultimately a ferry company crossing a very, very small stretch of water between the UK and the Europe mainland. However, it does sort of flag up something really quite astonishing. I've never seen a boss being quite so blatant. Well, the reason, he said, for not consulting unions, which would be a centuries-old practice in this country, is that he didn't think that they would be able to come up with a deal that would anyway be digestible by the unions. And he didn't want to submit, quotes, the officials to the humiliating exercise of going through a negotiation that wasn't going anywhere. I mean, I feel like the Industrial Revolution's mill owners could have come up with that one very, very satisfactorily. So yes, pretty blatant. I think a new level of shamelessness. I mean, I'm not sure even the Brexit voters had this quite in mind when they thought that the UK would be able to govern their people and protect their staff, and this would all be about taking back control. Because what he's done is absolutely sack people indiscriminately in the interests of saving 3,000 other jobs, he was quick to say, obviously including his own.
Yes, and, indeed, at £325,000, which the Times is keen to note. The interesting thing he also says is, I'm very sorry about this, but he would do it again. I mean, what does it say about the way that business feels that it can behave nowadays in the UK?
Well, I mean, Emma, this is an enormous subject because it comes from the state politic down, doesn't it? A new level of shamelessness of lying and then lying about lying and then not apologising when being caught out. So I think that's a big conference for where that one started. But it clearly isn't going away. And he has walked out of the chamber and back to his high paying job, and no sanctions or enforcements or rules have been. He's not going to be penalised for it thus far.
Finally, a compelling article in The Guardian here in the United Kingdom. Now, look, I think we have to accept that lockdown didn't do much for many of our waistlines, and many of us are still struggling to find that waistline that was last seen in 2020. We're not alone in this. Everybody's pets are feeling the bulge as well. Is that right?
Yes, according to The Guardian, which have conducted a poll of, we're not quite sure of how many people, but let's look at Instagram accounts where thousands of followers have been posting beautiful, cute pictures of rather oversized pooches and cats. And the point they're making, so they think it's twofold, is that, yes, lockdown, one little treat for Felix, didn't seem to do any harm on a Thursday, but it became a little treat on a Friday and a Saturday as well. And now we have an actual obesity problem across the nation with our favoured pets, which is obviously very sweet when pictures are posted, but not much fun when you hear of somebody like a huge dog, a huge chocolate Labrador called Blue, who's shaped like a barrel and is so overweight that he's got arthritis now and pressure on his joints. So these pets, I think the serious message is that they're not having much fun, but people are enjoying posting all these lovely, very, very cuddly pictures on social media. And so this is, again, all as usual, the great problem between how it looks and how it really is.
Beautifully written article as well. There's a 7-year-old Pomeranian George who's described as an overstuffed draft excluder. Caroline Frost, thank you so much for joining us on The Globalist. You're listening to Monocle 24.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
And you're back with The Globalist live on Monocle 24, where the time in Paris is 8:45 a.m. And it's where we head next to find out the latest in fashion news with Dana Thomas, Paris-based author of Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes. Good morning, Dana.
Good morning.
Lovely to have you with us. Let's abandon Paris for a moment and head to New York, where Ralph Lauren has just done New York like only Ralph Lauren possibly could.
Absolutely. Ralph decided to have his fashion show after the whole fashion season and hosted at the Museum of Modern Art, the MoMA, where he recreated the living room of his apartment. Originally, he wanted to have the show in his apartment, but his son thought that might not be a good idea. Maybe it's big, but it's not that big. So they recreated it with sofas and coffee tables with stacked with coffee table books and flowers and roses and bowls of M&Ms. Ralph apparently loves to have M&Ms always within reach. And put out a really beautiful collection of just classic Americana, whether it was for evening a handsome tuxedo for men and women or black sequin gowns. And most importantly, he has a new ad campaign and a new collection that he has created in partnership with Morehouse College and Spelman College, two universities that are known as are part of the historically black colleges and universities that are in America that taught black students during segregation. These two schools, most of them are in the South, and these two schools are outside of Atlanta. And he has created a collection with them that's like a license, and he's put them he shot the campaign on students and academics, and he has made this part of his ad campaign for the spring, and it was part of this whole new message with the new show this season. Very inclusive.
And it looks right, and it seems to be the right thing to do now. I mean, how much of a trailblazer is Ruffler in doing this? It seems like a very positive and indeed productive move.
It is. It feels like, why wasn't this done a long time ago? Why was there a whole swath of America kind of left out of the Ralph Lauren image and dream that was very waspy, very, you know, F. Scott Fitzgerald, very, you know, Hampton-esque. And, you know, back for a long time, that was very exclusive to a very sort of preppy white face, or at least the image of that. And that he is finally tapped into this, I think is wonderful in its, you know, inclusivity, but also it just broadens his entire market, because, you know, you go to the South and you have these wonderful colleges with these very fabulous students who have great sense of style. And why weren't they all always in Ralph Lauren ads and campaigns, you know?
Let's move on from the absolute sleek elegance of Ralph Lauren to Alexander McQueen, which slightly took a different approach.
I mean, Sarah Burton and Alexander McQueen brought the collection to New York, and there's a little bit of a tradition. Alexander McQueen himself had taken his collection to New York twice during his lifetime. Why she did it now, so long after Fashion Week, we don't know. But they did, and they had a Brooklyn warehouse that they filled it with mushrooms and wood chips and compost, as if they were going to grow mushrooms. And yet then someone asked, are you going to start working with mycelium, the mushroom leather that so many companies are using these days as opposed to animal hide? And she said, oh, well, we're experimenting with it, but we're trialing it, but we're not using it. We're not putting it out in our collection yet. So the whole thing sort of seemed like, I don't quite understand what the message was. Why there were mushrooms in Brooklyn, why McQueen was in Brooklyn. But the clothes looked, you know, great. It was as green as she could be. 80 to 85% of the 41 looks used recycled fabrics, though that did include polyester. And you know, the dirt was going to be recycled and donated to a farm and to an art project. So there was, you know, some sort of green aspect to it. But it felt a little bit premature for what they were trying to say and what they actually did.
Finally, let's pay tribute to Annie Flanders, who's died. A lovely article in the New York Times about her. Amazing, really independent Details magazine. I mean, just let's place Annie and her magazine in fashion's history.
Well, I knew Annie. I loved Annie. I got to know Annie while working on my book, Fashionopolis, because one of her founding photographers, she created this magazine back in the early 80s, and I totally remember it when I was a model in New York in the early 80s, and it was on newsprint. It was a downtown magazine, And it covered the scene. It covered the nightlife in New York. And their tagline was, we're covering it. We're out there so you don't have to be. So basically, if you had a job and you wanted to know what was going on in downtown New York, but you had to be at work at 8 a.m., you could read details and you knew what was happening. And it was just, you know, it was very cool. And if you got your picture in details, wow, you were like the it girl. And one of her first photographers for details was Bill Cunningham, the one who went on to the New York Times for years and rode his bicycle around. And there's a documentary about him. We love Bill. And Bill, she would give Bill 100 pages to cover the fashion show season in Europe and New York. Can you imagine? She was the first one to give John Galliano back in 1986 or 85, I think, several pages in the magazine for his first fashion show, and Bill shot it. And she also had for party pictures Patrick McCullen, who is this legendary party photographer still with and has a photo agency. And if you have a party, you call Patrick McCullen and he covers your party. And she had, you know, she had Hal Rubinstein as her food and fashion journalist, and he went on to be a major editor in InStyle.
Dana, thank you so much for that. I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there because it's fast approaching the time when we join Andrew Muller for his episodes of What We Learn.
We learned this week that a divided nation narrowly voting to leave an economic and customs union because an amount of its citizens don't like foreigners very much, and a nation unifying to mount a heroic armed resistance in an existential struggle against a predatory invader are literally exactly the same thing. We learned this because UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson... Pace yourselves, because UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson said this out loud in public where people could hear him.
I know that it's the instinct of the people of this country, like the people of Ukraine, to choose freedom every time. I can give you a couple of famous recent examples. When the British people voted for Brexit in such large numbers, I don't believe it was because they were remotely hostile to foreigners. It's because they wanted to be free, to do things differently, and for this country to be able to run itself.
Well, quite. We learned that among the very many people not having this honking nonsense was Ukraine's former president, Petro Poroshenko, who was manning a sentry post and wearing a khaki flak jacket, along with an expression of incredulous exasperation, when he retorted thus.
How many citizen of United Kingdom died because of Brexit? Zero. Can you imagine how many Ukrainians died before they met Putin aggression? Thousands. Can I ask you how many houses were destroyed because of the Brexit? And we have the whole cities which were completely erased.
We learned, however, that Boris Johnson was not the only public official experiencing a measure of difficulty keeping things in perspective. We learned that the mayor of Mondorf-les-Bains, which is apparently a real town, in Luxembourg, which is apparently a real country, had been embroiled in a controversy over a bust in a park commemorating Yuri Gagarin, the cosmonaut who became the first person in space back in 1961. Some local burghers believe that in light of events, the statue should be removed, despite it being hotly debatable how much responsibility is really borne for Russia's invasion of Ukraine by a Soviet Air Force colonel who has been dead for 54 years. While the mayor was unsold on the point of removing the monument, he decided to cover it to deter vandals. Do we have a sound effect that sounds like a statue being wrapped in a tarpaulin? Seriously, if the British Podcast Awards don't bite this year, screw them. Anyway, this action has since been both celebrated and damned as an act of censure, and speaking with rare but commendable honesty, the mayor told agog local media that he no longer knows what is right or wrong, and the man would doubtless be grateful for some general muttered agreement at this difficult time. But the mayor of Mondorf-les-Bains is scarcely alone, because we continue to learn that one does not need to be a subscriber to the snivelling self-pity, currently masquerading as so very much Russian diplomacy, to believe that some expressions of indignation at Russia's current atrocious behaviour are rather parting company with the plot, often prompting 180-degree handbrake reversals. We learned that an Italian university had postponed and then abruptly unpostponed a course in the lengthy and glum novels of Fyodor Dostoevsky, who, while indisputably Russian, breathed his last in 1881, and at any rate was not a noted fan of Russian authoritarianism, and served 4 years on the Siberian salt pile to prove it.
Old, he's too old to cut the mustard anymore.
And we learned that a similar brouhaha had consumed the United States National Mustard Museum in Middleton, Wisconsin, which, we learned when we looked it up on TripAdvisor, is rated the number one thing to do in Middleton, Wisconsin, presumably just ahead of lying down on the railway tracks. Big hello to our listeners in Middleton, Wisconsin. What happened was this. Early in the current war, the National Mustard Museum acted decisively, removing from display their collection of Russian mustards and replacing them with a sign bearing the following explanation, as will now be read by Monocle 24's cancelled condiments desk chief, Carlotta Ribello.
The Russian mustards have been temporarily removed. They will return once the invasion of Ukraine is over and Russia recognizes and respects the sovereign nation of Ukraine.
We learned that this proved, incredibly, insufficient to budge the thinking of President Vladimir Putin, but that it was plenty enough to earn the National Mustard Museum a cacophony of derision from online chortlers and/or whimsical news monologues, as a consequence of which we learned the Russian mustards have now been returned to their case. We cannot tell you precisely where we learned the details of this relish-related row, as we, like all good reporters, would never betray our sources. And we learned that despite all the above, and despite the reasons for all of the above, UEFA had received a bid to host the 2028 European Football Championships from Russia. So we learned that we may have to rethink the popular stereotype of Russians as pessimists. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller.
He's too old to cut the mustard anymore.
My thanks to Monocle's contributing editor Andrew Muller for that. That's all we have time for today's programme. Many thanks to all our guests and to our producers Rhys James, Paige Reynolds, Charlie Fimmercourt and Emma Sell, our researchers Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, Lillian Fawcett and Samson Bogo, and our studio manager Nora Hole with editing assistance from Christy Evans. The Globalist is back on Monday morning from 7am right here in London. For now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you for listening and have a great weekend.